I'm going to give a 2-minute warning. I'm also going to go out into the hallway and do the same. So let's get underway. Hopefully those that are in the hallway will filter in. Our goal is to continue through these measures and votes as we were immediately before lunch. We do have a couple of developers that we need to hear from, and one is the Society of Vascular Surgery. It's going to have to break in at 1:30 in order to describe what their measures are. So hopefully we can get through one or two of these measures prior to them. And we do have Dr. Dutton present. Hopefully by the time Dr. Dutton can describe the pancreatic resection mortality rate measure, and perhaps you could do this along with resection volume, reflecting on the earlier discussion, and then maybe we'll be ready to vote if enough people are back in. Thank you.
All right. Pancreatic resection mortality and volume. The group generally thought these measures were important, usable, feasible, and met the scientific applicability. The particular issues identified were first discussion about whether there should be two different measures or one harmonized measure or one measure that combined both. I think we've had some of that discussion about esophageal resection already. And I think probably the same would apply, is two measures but a companion or paired, so they would always be reported together, probably makes the most sense. It's both simple and gets both pieces of data on the table. There were a couple of questions about harmonizing just these two together. They actually measure slightly different things, and that one, the mortality measure is specifically for cancer surgery, whereas the other measure is not, is for any pancreatic resection. The volume measure, looking at the ICD-9 codes, it's only complete pancreatic resection, so we sort of wondered what happened to the partial resections and partial operations, and one of them listed a lot more codes in than the other. That should probably all be harmonized. There was a problem. I identified that the mortality measure, actually both measures, exclude transfers. So if you transfer the patient to another acute care hospital, they disappear from both the numerator and the denominator, which if you're a small volume pancreatic hospital and you're getting bad results, if you can ship the patient downtown, this seems like a great racket. And I know that happens, so that would seem a bad exclusion there. And then finally, there was one section in the I think the volume one where it was actually said esophageal is just a typo or a miscut and paste from the other measure that they need to clean up. I think that was everything that we identified as the important issues.
Could we have a comment from Art on why transfers are excluded?
Yes, this is Patrick Romano. I'm happy to join you. I'm a general internist supporting the ARC Quality Indicators Program from UC Davis. So Just to address a couple of those questions, so transfers out are excluded because, of course, the outcome of those patients is unknown. If you only have data from your own center, or if you're using a data set, as most users do, that is not linked across sites. So ideally, of course, we'd like to have a 30-day measure, and some payers would be able to specify a 30-day measure, but the ARC measures are designed for applicability to a broader range of data sets, which do not generally permit that kind of linkage across hospitals. We have looked at this empirically in the California data set that does allow linkage, and you might be surprised to find that, in fact, the post-transfer mortality is quite low because most of those are sort of back transfers to a community hospital setting or a rural hospital after the patient has had the aggressive procedure at a teaching center, and then they go back to a site that's closer to their home for some further recovery. So, in fact, what we see empirically is that post-transfer mortality is quite low in the linked data set in California anyway. The other issue as far as the difference in denominators, this is an issue that we've discussed in the first round of endorsement. It's also been discussed with LeapFrog. The rationale basically is that, of course, the mortality is much higher for the cancer surgery, but the benign surgery, experience with benign surgery, appears to translate into better outcomes for both patients with benign disease as well as patients with malignant disease. So including benign disease in the volume measure kind of gives providers the benefit of the doubt for doing procedures on patients who have benign disease. So that's the rationale, but it is subject to change. It's just evolved through discussions with expert panels previously.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, hi. I'm Renee Stafford, and I'm actually the one that brought up why the benign patients were excluded. Can you give me a little more background on that? I still don't quite understand the rationale.
Oh, well, these indicators are based on an empirical literature that is overwhelmingly based on cancer surgery. There have been a couple of large meta-analyses, mostly based on observational studies, and they were limited to pancreatic cancer surgery. There is, of course, a difference in mortality between patients with pancreatic cancer surgery and patients with surgery for benign disease. That difference in mortality could theoretically be adjusted for through risk adjustment. So that is an option. It's just that we kind of tailored the original definition to what other investigators have reported on in the literature.
So should it be titled instead pancreatic resection for cancer? Because it seems to me actually it'd be more important to know what the mortality is for benign disease, since the patients wouldn't otherwise necessarily die from their disease process.
It is a valid point. At this point, you know, the indicator specification is what it is, but we can certainly perform some additional analyses to explore what the impact would be of including or stratifying separately for benign disease.
Well, my recommendation there would be just to count both, you know, all pancreatic disease in both the numerator and the denominator, both these measures, that would keep them harmonized. It's a low enough volume condition that I think trying to subset it further isn't really helping you.
I actually was more implying for benign disease, a separate measure, because I think measuring mortality for benign disease, as I said, is almost more important because you wouldn't otherwise die of your disease process and you would otherwise die of pancreatic cancer if you don't have your resection.
Right, I agree. Yeah, I think you have to split these two out.
Other than sort of emergency sort of pancreatic debridement, what other benign conditions lead people to have major pancreatic surgery? I mean, other than IPIMs, I mean, that's now almost becoming classified as a malignancy. So the question is, you know, because that's...
You shouldn't live with benign disease at all.
Yeah, so the question, I think the point is that it's such a low frequency thing. If anything, I would say an exclusion should be a diagnosis of pancreatitis, because those patients, you know, in an ICU setting who are getting, which fortunately are very rare anymore, but that's a whole different kettle of fish. I mean, those patients have a 40% mortality or 30% mortality as is. But, you know, what benign condition do we operate on in such high volumes of the pancreas?
Volume is a paired measure, is that right? Yeah. So they're always reported together.
That's the way they were endorsed to be reported, as paired measures.
I'm just looking through the exclusion criteria again, just to make sure that, you know, in cases of, you know, splenectomies and the tail of the pancreas gets removed, I'm just worried about the possibility of coding variability here that could cause a problem with the data. You know, a resection for a renal, a major surgical oncology procedure in which you do a partial pancreatectomy, but it's for a primary renal or splenic tumor or retroperitoneal sarc. So you'd have to be able to exclude those as well.
Could I ask Melinda for some guidance? We have some suggestions of some fairly significant modifications in the way that this measure is constituted. Do we just proceed and vote on it as is, or how would you suggest we go ahead?
Much the same way you had done, which would be, if there are recommendations, suggestions, conditions that you would apply to the measure, that those be stated and that we get the response from the developer and then vote the measure based on that.
Well, I'd suggest that we've heard enough concerns around the table over inclusions, exclusions, and how to address this that we're not prepared to vote. So should we put off the vote and lay out what those concerns are? I think pancreatitis is clearly one. Resection for pancreatitis probably shouldn't count as a pancreatic resection for this purpose. And then the question as to whether or not we should include and lump benign and cancer, or whether we should split and or exclude benign from one or both of the measures. Any further comments on those?
Let me just sort of muddy the waters just a little bit, though. In terms of, I'll aim this at sort of Vivian and the other surgeons in the group here. In terms of the impact of disease, which is what you're concerned about, within a 30-day window, whether we're dealing with, you know, pancreatic CA in nodes, or, you know, a small cyst or an IPMN in the tail of the pancreas, probably doesn't matter. Which, as I talk about and think about it, brings us back to, you know, a more unified approach, you know, as this proposes. Because I like this, you know,
but to include all pancreatectomies.
Yeah.
So that would include all pancreatectomies for malignant or benign disease, for both mortality and volume, with the sole exclusion of pancreatitis.
I think so.
one of the things that would be helpful there would be to look at the numbers. In one of the measures, in 366, at the beginning under disparities, it gives some volumes for a sample, but in 365, it doesn't give the volume, it just gives the rate. And, you know, so the numbers are probably available that to look at, and it would be interesting to see how the volumes compare for benign and malignant disease, and also how the mortality rates compare.
I think it makes sense to kind of keep them together for any reason that these are relatively rare operations. There's not a lot of them going on. I think there was maybe 3,000 Whipples done last year, so there's not a lot of them. So that's one argument to kind of keep them together. The other thing is it's mainly the organ that helps determine a lot of these complications. So regardless if there's cancer or if there's any other reason for the operation, it's the fact that the pancreas is so hard to work with that can lead to problems. So
we actually had a very similar discussion about the esophageal measure last time, where the mortality figure dealt with cancer cases and the volume credited the hospital with a few extra percent for overall esophageal volume. But I don't think it really is changing the way the wind is blowing on this, because the number of pancreas procedures for benign disease is relatively small, and if a hospital, I say, upgrades their numbers by 10 or 20% by including all pancreatic procedures, it's not going to really change the impact of the measure one way or the other. So maybe a lot of discussion about something that really isn't affecting the bottom line on this.
Yeah, this is Patrick Romano again. I just wanted to emphasize that these measures were created through a process of reviewing the published evidence. And so, again, you know, the published evidence is largely limited to resection for pancreatic cancer, because that is the overwhelming majority of the pancreatic resection. So I appreciate the point about benign disease, but it is kind of going beyond the evidence on which the indicator was based. So that's why we have an expert panel. We have an ARC expert panel process that led to this specification. The decision was made to give the hospitals credit, essentially, for the additional volume that they might get, 10%, 20% additional volume with benign cases. But the core of the concept is based on the literature on pancreatic surgery mortality. With respect to exclusions, that's easier to address. I think we could easily accept exclusions that this group wants to propose as just part of the next revision process.
Okay, so I would say we table the vote for the time being, that we ask for data on these topics that you just explained, and to contemplate an exclusion for pancreatitis, and that on further review a decision ought to be made whether to try to harmonize the volume and resection mortality all into the same boat. So are we okay to move on to the next measure?
And we need to bring that back by the time of the call that we'll have in follow-up to this meeting. So.
All right, so it's now 1:27. I don't think we'll get through perforated appendix in 3 minutes. Do we have our vascular surgery developers on the phone?
Nick Beard is here.
I'm sorry, could you say that again? I wasn't able to understand.
Sure, no problem. This is Nick Beard.
Great.
How are you today?
Very well. So there are a series of vascular surgery measures before us for consideration. Could you give us a brief summary as the developer? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were the SVS person. I apologize. So we need to wait for the Society of Vascular Surgery person to come on the phone. Is there any way that we can be notified of that other than just asking?
If you want to go ahead to the next measure, and then we can check.
At the end of that. Okay. All right. Very good. So we are at perforated appendix, And Dr. Morton?
Yep. This is a another AHRQ measure. It's perforated appendix admission rate. This has been something that's been measured quite frequently in surgery from time immemorial to know if it's if there's a quality problem. The particular measure is important for a few reasons. It's got scientific validity. It's been very easy to implement. Unlike a lot of the administrative measures that are out there, this has actually been had a referendum clinically where went into patients' charts to confirm the actual diagnosis. Dr. Romano was involved with all of that. So from that end, it's pretty useful. In terms of meeting some of the measures, it's useful in looking at different things such as clinical management, waiting until an appendix perforates can have some untoward consequences. There's also a big performance gap. I was surprised to see it's, you know, on order of about 20 to 30% of appies are perforated, so there's still a lot of potential opportunity there. A lot of data and literature around the topic, particularly when it comes to access to care. It seems like there's a higher rate based on your socioeconomic status, based on your rural status, so there's some evidence for disparity that have been addressed. Has some pretty important consequences when there is perforation in terms of longer length of stay and other resource utilization. And as I mentioned before, there's quite a bit of quite a few perforated appendectomies that are out there. So those were the main points. It seems to be a feasible and important measure with scientific validity.
Any other comments? Okay.
I just wanted to clarify for the group that this is a population-based measure, so it's not a measure that's intended for attribution to individual surgeons or hospitals.
Right. We discussed on the call it's reported by region.
Right.
Okay. So let's go to the vote. Importance to measure, yes or no? Yes, 2 no.
Hello. I don't know if you can hear me. This is Tim Creswick from the Society for Vascular Surgery. I was on before, but apparently somehow my line was muted, so I had to go through the operator to get in. So I am here, or was here, and still am.
Okay, we will be with you in about 30 seconds. We've gotten really quick at voting these in. So we have just three more votes. Should take us about 30 seconds. A scientific acceptability on a scale of 1 to 4. Keep pushing those buttons. Yes. 16 completely, 5 partially. Usability. Completely, 2 partially, 1 not at all. Feasibility. Completely, 3 partially. Finally, yes, no, or abstain. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? 20 yes, 1 no. Thank you. So if we could hear then on the SBS measures, please, from the developers.
Thank you. Again, this is Tim Krezak. I'm a vascular surgeon at the University of Iowa, representing the Society for Vascular Surgery. I've been involved in measure development going back a long ways, back to the original Cooperative Cardiovascular Project, and have spent a long time acting as a consultant or facilitator for all kinds of measure development. So I wish I could to try to introduce a group of measures just sort of as an overview, because I think these are a kind of a unique approach. And so I'd like, if I could, just to start out and talk about measures 1523, 1534, 1540, and 1543.
That's exactly how we'd like to do it, too, if you could cover them all together.
Okay, perfect. So the basic concept here is to try to get away from some of the problems and perverse incentives that are associated with current approaches to measurement of, if you will, surgical mortality or other complications. What we're trying to do with this group of measures is to try to focus on a procedure and an outcome that requires minimal risk adjustment. And in these cases, what we're talking about, I'll start first with the probably the carotid procedures would be easier to introduce. But the basic principle here is that the majority of carotid revascularization procedures performed in this country are done on asymptomatic individuals. And in that setting, the risk versus benefit is quite narrow. So it's essential for those group of patients that procedures are performed with an extremely low mortality and morbidity, and an important component of that is the selection of patients who are at low risk. And that becomes part of the surgical decision making, and therefore requires no further risk adjustment. In fact, you would not want to, if you will, give credit for someone performing interventions on someone who is at high risk because of comorbidities, or people who have shortened life expectancy because of their comorbidities. Because in order to achieve benefit in that patient population, the asymptomatic population, the risk needs to be quite low. And it's always hard. I participated in many of these on a phone versus an in-person meeting. So I'm just going to stop this for a second and just see if everybody's still listening or if there's any questions about that overall principle.
Any questions? That sounds like a very succinct approach.
So
I have one question. When you say asymptomatic, so would you qualify somebody who has a transient ischemic attack but otherwise and then resolves and doesn't have another one? Is that an asymptomatic patient or is that a symptomatic patient at that point?
A very important question. And the issue in this case is we actually talk about three levels of symptomatic status. And again, I don't know the composition of the group in the room, so I'm going to try to keep it at a fairly a layperson level. But the issue for as far as the data, the randomized trials that have been done support a strong benefit for patients who have hemispheric or clear strokes or transient ischemic attacks within a relatively short period of time. The studies are, let's say, for the major trials, approximately 120 days or 4 months. So for the purpose of the way we've defined this measure, those patients would be classified as symptomatic. So these are patients who have clear hemispheric that's on the same side of the carotid that's being operated on within 4 months of the procedure. The group that we would have a second group, which we would call other symptomatic, which would include the patients that would have had a event sometime in the remote past, okay, that's beyond the 120-day window, and would also cover patients who have neurologic events in the vertebrobasilar circulation or perhaps have had events in the contralateral hemisphere to the carotid being operated on. And so those two groups would be separately classified, but this measure is focusing on everybody else, which is the patients who are truly asymptomatic in the sense that they've never had a stroke or transient ischemic attack in any distribution at any time. These are purely asymptomatic, and again, from good data in the Medicare population, that's still approximately 60 to 70% of the patients who are receiving, at least for carotid endarterectomy, in this country. So it's the vast majority, but these are patients who are completely asymptomatic. Does that answer the question?
Yes, this is Nick Sears. I'm a retired vascular surgeon, so I just want to clarify that.
Okay. So, and I noticed there's some other measures, and I'll just talk about it. I've been one who has strongly advocated against volume-based measures because they, in fact, encourage overuse and potentially, as I said, create a perverse incentive for people to operate on more and more patients for whom the benefit is small. So I think the other advantage of this approach is it does not have the perverse incentive of encouraging overuse, and hopefully in that way also will lead to cost reduction, if you will, in the country. So the advantage of this approach, as I said, is the simplicity of once you define this population as the asymptomatic, you need to do no further risk adjustment. And then you can focus just on the event, which in this case would be stroke or mortality. I can stop there and then I can go on to the aneurysm measures. But,
no, please go on.
Okay, so you want me to talk about the aneurysm measures then?
Yes.
So the aneurysm measures are designed to be the same basic principle. Again, the data that would support aneurysm repair in the case of non-ruptured aneurysms, this is purely a preventive operation. So the risk versus the benefit has to be balanced on an individual patient level. We have pretty good data about the likelihood of rupture risk based on size. And there's a slight size difference between men and women. But the basic principle here is if you focus on the non-ruptured aortic aneurysms that are, if you will, of small to what we call moderate size, you don't need to do further risk adjustment, just as I discussed with the carotid. The basic principle here is that should be part of the decision-making. You don't, again, want to give credit to someone who's taking a very sick individual or someone with a shortened life expectancy and fixing a smaller, moderate size aortic aneurysm. The likelihood of harm versus benefit in that case would weigh against the procedure. So it's exactly the same as what we were talking about before. It minimizes the need for any further risk adjustment as it's part of the surgical decision making. So I'll just stop there. That's really the principle behind these four measures. Is just separating into separate categories the endovascular approach to aortic aneurysms versus the open approach, two separate measures focusing on those populations, and the same for carotid endarterectomy and carotid stenting.
You want to say anything about the surveillance measure?
Sure. The surveillance measure is, again, based on the principle that
If patients are undergoing endovascular aortic aneurysm repair, they do require some post-procedure surveillance to make sure that there are no potential complications that could increase the risk of future rupture. There's, I think, a fair amount of controversy as to exactly what the time interval needs to be, exactly what the imaging modalities need to be, and this measure is designed to be sort of a, a fairly minimalistic approach of saying at least one surveillance study between 3 and 15 months, which is a, is really sort of the floor, if you will, for what might be ideal, and does not necessarily specify the type of imaging study, just that imaging study needs to be one for which you can comment on size and any evidence of endoleak. So, again, I think this would be a, I don't think anyone would argue that this would be the absolute minimum that should be done for these patients.
Okay, thank you. I had a question, if I could. The question is, given that the endo leak rate is so high, it's been estimated 30 to 60% in some studies, should you be more prescriptive about the frequency of imaging as well as the type of imaging, since this appears to be a very common occurrence?
Why don't we get to that when we discuss? Are you, Tim, are you going to be able to stay on the call, or are you...
No, I certainly can. I'm available.
Okay, so why don't we get to that when we get to specifically discussing the measures. So thank you very much for that introduction. We're going to now go back to our agenda and follow along in the order that we were set to go. So we have incidental appendectomy in the elderly is the next item up for vote, John.
Yep. So this is another AHRQ measure, and it's looking at incidental appendectomy in the elderly. This one generated a little bit more comment and questions than the previous one about perforated appy. It appears to be a relatively rare event. The data that was submitted looked anywhere from about 20 to maybe mid-30s. Per 1,000 appendectomy, so relatively rare. There's some supplemental data that was provided from the state of Texas that was even lower, about 2 out of 1,000. I think there's good science behind the reasoning for the measure. A lot of data has come out, particularly out of Mayo, looking at performing an appendectomy when it's not indicated leads to more problems than it's worth. The one other question that came up in looking at the measure was there was an exclusion for colon cancer. I'm wondering if there should be an exclusion for ovarian cancer, since a lot of GYN oncologists do try to remove the appendix at the same time. What the measure has going in its favor is there are not that many elderly markers of quality out there, so that's one thing. I think the only question mark really from my end was whether or not this was something that was useful to measure, given that the numbers are fairly small.
Other comments?
I just had one follow-up. I know the exclusion for colon cancer, but there's a fair number of operations in colorectal surgery that you do that involve the right colon for polyps, benign neoplasms, colitis, that involve removal of the appendix as part of the procedure. Not because it's abnormal, it's just stuck to the colon there and it needs to come out. And the pathologist often reported as a separate specimen, they'll say appendix, you know, without diagnostic abnormality. How would that be handled by this? Because it's colectomies are in the group that gets included. I mean, I just was wondering about that.
Yes, I can address that. So the exclusion list includes basically all colectomies that involve the either the entire colon or the right side of the colon. They also exclude the pelvic exonerations. And there's separate exclusion for patients who have either malignant neoplasm of the colon or malignant neoplasm of the retroperitoneal or peritoneal tissues or peritoneal carcinomatosis, basically, as well as secondary malignant neoplasms that involve those structures. So I think that those cases would be excluded. The ovarian cancer would might still get in here if the patient did not have a pelvic degeneration and if the patient did not have visible peritoneal carcinomatosis.
The only other comment I'd make is that there's a lot of data and interest in the perforated AFI measure. Not a whole lot has been kind of done with the measure, at least in the literature regarding it. So the question is, we're collecting them, but what are we going to do with it?
So in the sea of metrics that we are all forced to collect, is this one that we really need to do? I mean, is this really going to make a difference in terms of geriatric surgery or whatever?
Well, you know, to Peter's point, I think this is one that might fall into that category about being a legacy measure, if you will. It's kind of a, again, not a large volume. Not sure if it really is impactful on the quality of care for the elderly.
The other question I had back to the exclusions, and they're up there on the board, and we talked about this in the conference call. I'm not sure why you would exclude a transverse colon resection, a left hemicolectomy, a sigmoidectomy, because those are operations where you wouldn't normally take out the appendix. It's not associated with those types of resections, so I was wondering why that was excluded.
One. Going to make a guess, and I'm on thin ice here, but the notion was that the downside of a incidental appendectomy is exposing the lumen of the large bowel, and that deed has already been done, I would guess, in what you cited.
That was the rationale. Plus the possibility there might be some confusion in the coding as far as what particular segments of the colon had been removed.
So Melinda, if I could ask the importance question or the question of whether this remains relevant or whether this should become inactive or moved to the Hall of Fame, do we address that when we do this first vote on importance to measure?
Right. So if the group determines that it is not important to measure by virtue of the level of performance essentially being topped out, then the rest, so then it could be a candidate for moving to an inactive status, assuming that the group also agrees that all of the other criteria, scientific accessibility, usability, feasibility, are met.
Okay, so importance to measure, one yes, two no. Six yes, 15 no. So let's pause at this moment. Then I guess the question is, does this imply that we're topped out and it's no longer important to measure, or does it imply that the measure itself is not of value and should be dropped?
And that's the question that the group has to answer. Is it, have you voted that it's not important because it is topped out? And if that's not the reason, then we don't proceed.
I could address the issue of topped out. So looking at the national data over a period from 1994 through 2007, the rate was 28.6 per thousand in 1994. In 2000, it was 26.7. In 2005, it was 20.5, and in 2007, it was 19.6. So it's dropped from 28.6 to 19.6 per thousand over a 14-year period from 1994 to 2007. Still about 2% overall.
So I guess my impression based on the discussion was really not a sense that this was had been sort of successfully put to bed, the topped-out hypothesis, but more that it was of dubious relevance and value, which would mean that we would not inactivate it, but rather we would eliminate it. Is there a way that we can revise the vote to reflect those two alternatives?
Well, we will capture the reason for the vote.
Okay.
So you do not need to re-vote. We just need to be crystal clear that the reason for the no vote is other than being tossed out.
Okay. I was a no vote. It certainly was for me. Does anyone feel otherwise that voted no, that this was...
So we stop there.
Okay. Thanks. So now we have the first measure from the... from the ASC Quality Collaboration, Hospital Transfer / Admission 0265.
This measure assesses whether patients admitted to an ambulatory surgery center were transferred to a hospital or admitted to a hospital upon discharge from the ASC. The rationale for the measure is that about 80% of surgeries are performed on an outpatient basis, and patients selected for ambulatory surgery are not anticipated to require hospital care upon discharge. Therefore, high rates may be an indicator that patient selection guidelines are in need of review. Workgroup A reviewed this measure, and it did have a number of concerns. We felt that the measure, as written, could potentially have unintended consequences, encouraging a discharge to home with instructions to go to the ER if there's problems, because if the patient is discharged home and then goes to an ER, that's a success from the standpoint of the measure, whereas if the patient is directly admitted, that's a failure. And so we felt that a better numerator time frame would be if the patient is admitted to the hospital instead of being at the time of discharge, if it were within some number of hours, maybe 24, maybe something shorter than that, but that the measure needed to include discharges within some time frame or admissions to the hospital within some time frame after discharge from the ASC. Also, given the low admission rate in the data that were presented, the work group wondered if there's enough of a performance gap for the measure to be meaningful. We also noted a number of apparent discrepancies in the submission, and these are all kind of fine print, but play in. The data were presented for a convenience sample of 526 surgery centers, but there's also comment that results are publicly reported for 1,185. We weren't sure why we were only getting half the information if it's being publicly reported for twice as many as we got data on. In the statistical analysis section, it didn't seem like the statistical analysis was valid. There was a comment that how much deviation it took from the norm to be an outlier, but it seems like that would vary depending on the population for a given ASC. And also in some of the measures or in some of the data, the decimal points seem to be misplaced, and rates per thousand and percentages seem to be confused. So there were a couple of fine points that where the submission wasn't clear.
Don and David.
Yes, we also have Susan went on the phone. Susan, if you're on the phone, I know you're on a short schedule. Did you want to speak especially to the statistical issues that were raised?
Yeah, I can.
That'd be great.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. So in the statistical issue, the unit of analysis that we were using was percentages that were raised by ASC. So the unit of analysis is the ASC and not the patient. So that might be part of the confusion in the error rate. And I'm sorry. The the other time frame questions, I still, I'm sorry, I'm going to say, I apologize, as the delay kind of threw me off. All of the rates before the 5%, and I have Donna answer about the 500 versus the 1,000 for the public reporting.
I'm not sure why. Thank you, Susan.
I'm not sure why there's that discrepancy. The only thing that I can think of is that the 500 came from the ASC Association, and again, this is all self-reported data. I could get that for you, but it's self-reported, and that's those 500 are reported in more detail than the other 1,100. Again, it's facility data that's aggregated, so we don't have specific demographics and specifics, and so that's why I think the 500 came from is from the ASC Association's report.
Yeah, I want to apologize. That's a great point. It's something that unfortunately we're not able to investigate here on the fly, but we certainly need to clear that up, and I apologize to you all for not having had that addressed prior to coming in here. Let me just address one of the main excellent points that you brought up, and that was the issue of the timing. One of the things that we, and actually this was alluded to with some of your other measures, and I was interested to hear that it supervenes to other sites of service, and that is that when we were constructing these measures, we were very concerned to only try to elicit data that was observable or directly under control and reportable, therefore, during the continuum of care at the surgery center. So as soon as that patient leaves the center, we have no idea whether that patient got into a car wreck or went home and then ingested whatever, got the fishbone stuck in their throat, even though they'd had a hangnail removal at the surgery center. In other words, something completely unrelated. So we felt that there were many, many, many factors beyond our control regarding the health and the eventual outcome of that patient's surgical procedure after they left the facility. So while I appreciate the notion of the unintended consequences, I also want to speak to the fact that this really has no pejorative implications in terms of why to track this. This is really a global consideration for an ambulatory surgery center, which by CMS's definition is meant to treat patients for a time span of less than 24 hours. So it's very important that we have this data for our own centers. I think it's important to consumers so that they know that the centers are doing what they're supposed to be doing. It's very important to the regulators, but much more importantly, it is to the facilities so that they can really keep a good eye on their patient practices, and that covers pre-op, intra-op, and post-op. And for pre-op, it's really patient selection. We want to make sure that we're taking the right patients into our facilities. Intra-op, we want to make sure that we're not giving them too much medication so that they are unable to go home. And post-op, we want to make sure that not only have we chosen the right patients, but that we've arranged for appropriate post-operative care, treated post-operative nausea and vomiting, and perhaps pain in a timely and appropriate fashion. So the issue of direct transfer is a lot of because of the logistics of the surgery center, but we feel there was very, very much consideration, and we felt that the way that we did it, doing it only direct rather than attaching a time frame, was something that was worth tracking. I will tell you, however, that Medicare does track both 24 hours and 1 week return to surgery for these patients in the Medicare population, and we agree that those other kinds of indices, although they are specific for other issues, are also important to track, but they fall outside of the purview of this measure.
We follow this at our own institution, and it's not one of these less is better metrics. I mean, you don't want a zero rate. It's like having a zero negative appendectomy rate. But the way we use it is to track it longitudinally over time, where if there's a marked increase or decrease, then that really warrants a deep dive in individual patients to find out why there's a change in the pattern. So there may be a misunderstanding that less is better. I don't think that's the point of this metric.
Is there a known acceptable rate of transfer?
Again, it depends on the patient population and the type of surgery done in your particular ASC. I mean, we have one ASC that does unilateral knee replacements. So, you know, it all depends on the patient population that you're dealing with. But within your ASC, given a relatively stable patient population, fluctuations in your rate should trigger some alarms.
I would follow up with that and say, is this really a quality measure? You know, this is the option are do these patients at your surgery center with a slightly higher risk of admission or do them as an inpatient. And I'm not sure that their transfer from your surgery center to your hospital is an indicator that that's a poor quality or poor, leads to poor outcome. And in addition, the rate is so low, it's 0.1%. Is that really something that's going to be valuable to measure differences between surgery centers if they're that low, or even differences over time? It really has to do with the extent of things you do at your surgery center, how you're set up for these transfers, whether you do people with sleep apnea and things like that that have some trouble with postoperative blocks and things like that, that really are the options are doing these patients at the inpatient facility, which may not be a higher quality experience for them.
I think that you're all raising very good points, and actually we talked about this last time we were here when we initially presented this measure. I still think that it's a very important measure for a facility to track, and that's what I was saying about it. It's not pejorative. It's really something that you want to trend and then do analysis on, and you certainly cannot do that deep dive analysis or something along the lines of root cause to see what is it that's causing these an increase or a decrease in your transfer rate. We admit that they should be low, but within a facility, given the patient population and given the procedures that are performed in facilities, remember there's a wide range across ASCs. This is something that's very important, again, not only for patients and consumers, but something that the regulators are looking very closely at, and we have always been encouraged, especially by folks at CMS and at MedPAC, to continue to track, and they use these statistics and look at those very closely. So I would encourage you to encourage us to continue to have this as an endorsed measure that we keep track of. Again, knowing that a lot of times a transfer reflects actually good and sometimes preventive medicine and is always done in the best interest of the patient, but it is something that we want to keep a very close eye on, especially within a facility, for all the reasons that myself and others at the table have stated.
So how does it get publicly reported then to say that a given rate is not a bad thing? So like if, let's say you're doing, I don't know, the unilateral knees or, you know, people who are more sick. How do you report it in such a way, since this is for public reporting, that it doesn't become a punitive thing to that institution if they're doing the appropriate care?
I'm sorry. I think that what we have done in the past is we have the data reported on our site, and it includes an explanation such as some of the issues that we have raised at this table to make it very clear to all that would go to the site, including our patients as consumers, you know, what the implications are and more precisely what they aren't regarding any one of the indices that we track.
So it sounds like we don't know what the appropriate target is for transfer rate, and it also sounds like this isn't necessarily ready for prime time as a quality measure. I understand that that we're talking about it in terms of maintenance of the measure, but if we don't know what the number should actually be, then how can we say here's a target?
Can I get one point of clarification? Is this just for an ASC transfer from an ASC to the same hospital?
A hospital.
ASCs are required by Medicare conditions for coverage to have a transfer agreement with a local hospital, so that can be anyone in the community.
They're not necessarily the same healthcare system.
No, they do not have to be at all. Sometimes that's impossible. Of course, often that is the case, but that is not a requirement for regulation or for accreditation.
Thank you.
I absolutely agree with you when you talk about the importance of this measure. It sounds like it's important to measure and track for your organization and for individual ASCs, but it's unclear to me how it's important to track as a quality measure. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm going to try. I think it has a lot to do with the quality of care with pride, and again, that starts with the preoperative selection and preparation of our patients. So that includes making sure that they are someone that has some place to go to for postoperative care. It also means that we've evaluated them correctly for comorbidities and that these are patients that can indeed be appropriately done for that procedure on that day in that facility. And then it also goes to how we treat them intraoperatively, again, specifically the anesthetic, but also make sure that there's no intraoperative complications as a result of the surgical procedure itself. And then finally, it really relates very closely back to the postoperative care in terms of how we are able to treat postoperative pain, either with IV medication or pump or both, and postop nausea and vomiting and any other thing that would have a patient be transferred to a hospital for treatment and or evaluation.
So it's a black box. It's a big black box that encompasses a ton of stuff, and we know 0 is bad and 100% is bad. But it seems very fuzzy to me, so I completely agree with you. This is very important to understand and to dig into. But right now we're not creating a system for digging deeper or trying to identify clear, concise quality measures.
I think what we're saying is, what parameters do you use? If this is a quality measure to be measured, because that's what measure implies, how do you do it if you don't have a rate that's a target?
Well, maybe to add
just to follow up on that and what Richard said earlier, you have a rate here that goes from 0 to 2.3. The mean rate, as Jane pointed out, was 0.2 with a standard deviation of 0.1 with a standard deviation of 0.2%. You're doing a great job. And we'd like to see it as 0, but we said earlier the FCS was fine and it was topped out at 95%. You guys are 99% doing the right job. Why go through this exercise? I mean, for your institutions, you should track it, yeah, and make sure, but I'm not sure if Arden's point is that you guys are doing a great job, and should we continue to make this something we could say it's something ASC should do every year to check their rate, put it on the back shelf or whatever we've been calling it, as something to follow, but what we did earlier, just sort of not retire it, but inactivate it. But I think I'm not sure what all the all is.
I'd like to speak up for the measure. I think it's a good measure to take a closer look at, because the consequences can be pretty severe, and it also looks at the patient selection. A lot of things go into play here. It's not exactly germane to this discussion, but we have looked at ambulatory bariatric surgery. Yes, such a thing exists. And we've seen some very untoward results where a much, much higher mortality rate is associated with an ambulatory bariatric procedure. So I think this is something that needs to get measured. There's not a lot of good data out there about ambulatory cases being done. And I think the fact that we don't have a set rate for it, I don't think that's all that unusual sometimes in quality. Sometimes we are looking for those rates. And what is good now may not be good in the future. So I'd be careful about pegging it. I hate to keep bringing up bariatric surgery, but 10 years ago, 1% mortality was acceptable. It's now 0.2. So it's something I think that bears merit to continue to look at, because those cases are almost sentinel cases. They give you some insight as to what's going on around patient selection or even the case itself.
So how about a delta for change? So if you don't have a specific rate, why don't you look for a specific rate of change?
I'm wondering if instead of even looking at a rate, which we seem to have a little bit of a problem with, could we perhaps open up that black box by looking at best practices or guidelines that exist for various parts of this pathway? So patient selection, what needs to happen intra-op, what needs to happen post-op. Are there some evidence-based guidelines? I don't know. I'm asking.
Okay.
Is there something that we could use as processes to make sure that this is happening better as opposed to the rate?
I think one of the troubles, and I apologize, this is Donna talking, is that there is not a lot of evidence out there for ambulatory surgery, number one. Number two, we just don't have a lot of data. And number three, again, these are 1,200 facilities out of 5,200. Again, this is voluntary. And, when you talk about topped out, these are centers that have been doing this for multiple quarters. And I think that if you looked at the rest of the population, maybe their rates are much higher, but we don't know that. And again, I think from a quality standpoint, if a center has a high transfer rate, and I know you all asked the question, what's high, Personally, I think anything over 2%, you definitely have to do some digging in and finding out what's going on in that center, because it's either you're doing, you know, maybe you're doing a lot of higher level cases, bariatrics or total knees or total joints, but also maybe you're, you know, maybe you're just not doing a really good job on your pre-assessment, and that says a lot to the care that's going on in those facilities. And I don't know how to get the point across, but I am telling you all, for our industry, this is a huge measure, and it's really needed out there. But
I think we all agree that it's important.
Just the number.
Yeah. So how about something including, since it seems like the people who are involved in doing it now have done a good job. So maybe the target should be to get more involved, more centers involved.
And that is actually our goal. We're working on a registry this year. We do have some funds to allow anybody to come in and put their data in so we can get more centers, because we just don't know what's going to happen with CMS. We don't know if it'll be January 2012, 2013. We don't know.
Could I butt in for a sec? I'd like to recognize speakers, because there's a few people who are trying to talk who aren't as quick on the button.
Just two overarching issues. I think in some instances this is very analogous to some of the safety indicators. A low rate doesn't necessarily mean it's a thing you shouldn't track. We also do have some good examples of things like episiotomy, not a good thing, but we don't actually know what the right rate is. It's kind of dependent, but it's still an important indicator that you might want to track over time. My third issue with that I wanted to raise, again, a cross-cutting issue, is I think the idea of having a measure stop at the time they leave your door has sort of changed and evolved. There's a definite shift towards shared accountability. I suspect the number is significantly higher, and I'd be curious to hear what the research would suggest if you actually looked beyond that discharge time. But, you know, certainly many of us are held to 30-day accountability and things like that. So the idea that as soon as they leave your door, you're kind of done, I think is kind of old thinking, and I think it's really important to think about whether it's a 7-day window or whatever the case may be. If you over-medicate somebody and they're still woozy and they fall in your parking lot, sorry, but I do think that's the responsibility of the ASC.
But I think in aggregate, the measure makes sense, you know, in that it's forcing the ASCs to pay attention to this, and that the whole goal of a metric is to try to improve quality, its least focusing efforts, because a rate, again, that's too high or too low may prompt you to do root cause analysis. I think some of the scientific issues is that we're trying to dissect it apart a little too much and go be their quality committee and do their root cause analysis for them. And I do think that if you've got a group that's got a 5% rate, yeah, that's going to raise a red flag on a comparative basis. But I think in aggregate, it's not a perfect metric, but at least it's encouraging the ASCs to focus their attention on the area that does have some important potential quality impact.
If you were to publicly report this by institution, would consumers and prospective patients be able to make sense of the and discriminate between centers based on the data at this point?
I think that's an excellent question, and that's why, as I said, it is publicly reported now. It is on the ASC Quality Collaboration website. It's an aggregate number, not by facility.
But not by, if it were to be reported by facility, as maybe you guys hope in the future, would it be meaningful?
I think it would be very meaningful, but I think an informed consumer would very, very legitimately ask the exact same questions you are, and they're great questions to ask, but I just, you know, maintain that does not invalidate the reason that we should keep track of
it. I'm not suggesting it does. I just wanted that.
Yeah, no, it's a great question.
I raised my hand earlier. I mean, I spoke earlier about my feelings about this, but to follow up on another point, is that, you know, if you put someone out the door and they end up in the emergency room that night because they're having pain, you haven't done an adequate job of preparing them for their pain control. In our practice as a colorectal surgeon, 15% of my male patients who have bariatric anal surgery end up coming back within 24 hours because of urinary retention. I mean, you know, you are doing a procedure. I'm held responsible in the main hospital for readmission rates. Everyone else who does hospital-based work is held responsible for readmission rates. So, all right, so let's say there is a need to everyone to report it, then it just can't be walking out the door at the end of the road. If they show up in the hospital, I mean, I get in trouble for 30-day readmission. I get 30-day death. I've had two patients in the last 5 years who have been killed within 30 days in car accidents. It still comes back to me.
So, I mean, by going to the same, you know, responsibility does not end at the end of the procedure or when they walk out the door.
I was just going to get back to the, I just think if this is being reported as a quality metric, and I really don't think it's a measure of quality for individual patient. We know that most surgical outcomes have high quality in surgery centers. So in general, the quality of surgery is very, very strong there. If you have an option of in the hospital or at a surgery center, I can lower this rate by doing everybody that is a slightly higher risk in the hospital. It will drive up costs. It will lower this number for me, but it won't provide better quality for my patients. My patients, they're comparing two centers, won't be able to tell really what that means for them. So I do think it's important, and I do think it needs to be tracked. I just don't think it's a quality metric, and I don't think you've presented any evidence that those patients that are transferred back have lower, worse outcomes than if they've been done in the hospital, which is really the question.
I think this is a very important quality measure. I'm sorry, Jim, but from the anesthesiologist perspective, you have to collect and examine these people. You have to know what your rate is over time. 75% of the anesthesia we do now is in outpatients, and knowing that they stay outpatients is absolutely critical. It's pain management, it's management of nausea and vomiting, it's management of some surgical complications. I do absolutely agree with Helen, though. You have to push it out to 24-hour all-cause admission. You're calling all those people back the next day to get your satisfaction data. You can find out whether they got admitted or not.
So I'm going to take the prerogative of trying to summarize where we stand and then trying to figure out if there's a way to resolve. I guess a couple of things that I would observe is that this is... this is one of those things that calls the question of what does NQF certification actually mean, because there's no reason why ASCs could not continue to measure this measure ad infinitum without the NQF endorsement. So what does the NQF endorsement actually do? I would guess that maybe the NQF endorsement in this case helps to get the 1,200 up closer to the 5,000, which would probably be a good thing. I can't think of a downside of it unless we feel like we're endorsing a truly inferior quality measure, and it seems like there's strong opinions on both sides of that topic. And so I think my opinion of this would be we ought to go ahead and vote, see what the vote turns up. But I hope that the folks in the ambulatory quality world in these centers take this advice. Particularly, I would say, the early argument, David, that you made that, you know, somebody goes home and they cut themselves in the kitchen or, you know, some other completely unrelated event. I think that one's a little bit specious because that exists really for every quality measure that we have once somebody is discharged. There's always a baseline rate of mayhem in the population once they get out of our doors. And so that's a problem with every quality measure that you try to follow up on once a patient is discharged. So I would urge, and it may be through the satisfaction survey method, that you take to heart the advice that this would be a much more substantive measure if you actually had a 24-hour window at least around the admission piece, that hopefully if we vote this in, the next time you come back, you will have done some work on trying to accomplish that.
You raised the point of what does NQF endorsement add? Well, the NQF endorsement, according to the criteria we're using, has to do with internal quality improvement and also with public reporting. I think it sounds from the discussion like, you know, there's real agreement, I think, that this or some variation is very relevant for internal quality improvement. I think where the issue is the public reporting. And that's what the NQF endorsement adds, is a blessing on public reporting. And it just doesn't seem like it's ready for that.
I'd like to echo, David, what you said about the imprint of NQF. What you do is have this very nice data and very acceptable data on the people, on the centers who in fact have reported. But you have no knowledge of what goes on in the other. And I think that one of the things that this committee might want to consider in its charge is exactly that issue. Could the approval of a measure which may not be perfect, but is a good measure, because I heard that, but give them the kind of a little bit of extra muscle to get more people in. And I think that that's a very important responsibility for this committee and NQF in general. So I would support it on that basis.
Final comment from our developers, and I think
we'll I would just remind this group that, you know, we take very much all the issues that you've raised. I think they're excellent, and they're actually ones that we've discussed during measure development. But I can tell you from being, I guess, a pioneer in the industry of ASC quality reporting, and we are at the very, very embryonic stages, that the last 3 years of having the endorsement of this body has really allowed us to get great mileage. We started at zero 3 years ago, and we are now up to 1,600 centers and very close to getting even more than that as we're working on incorporation in a registry and our art grant and other things. So I can't tell you how much it has meant to us, even though this is maybe an imperfect measure, as maybe our others are, but to have had the approval and the endorsement of this body has been an exceptional boost for us and for our patients. So I appreciate that.
Thanks. Let's vote on importance. One is yes, two is no. We have at least one person out of the room. I think 20 is the number. So 15 yes, 5 no. Scientific acceptability on a scale of 1 to 4. So this one's a bit more trying. 2 completely, 10 partially, 6 minimally, 2 not at all. Usability. Six completely, 9 partly, 3 minimally, 2 not at all. Feasibility. Thirteen completely, 7 partially. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Here is a yes, no, or abstain. Thirteen yes, 7 no.
Can I ask a question? At this point, as you did with measures in phase one, do you want to ask that the developer come back to you with information about the 24-hour period?
Yes.
Okay.
Could we also ask that the measure take a look at the statistical analysis and the decimal points? There's rates per thousand and percentages that are mixed up, and the statistical analysis, I think, is lacking in a major way.
For clarification, can I just ask, are you asking us then to move it, to leave the measure as is and move it out to 24 hours? Is that what I'm hearing?
I think we'd like to hear a plan as to how it could be moved out to 24 hours, but for the time being, the measure is endorsed.
Okay, we will do that.
Let me clarify. What you voted on is whether or not the measure meets criteria for endorsement. the feedback that you bring back to the group will occur, and they will consider that prior to making a recommendation for endorsement.
So our next measure, 1517, statin therapy at discharge.
This measure assesses the percentage of patients undergoing infrainguinal lower extremity bypass who are prescribed a statin at discharge. It should be noted that the measure is defined in terms of medical record data. There's no clear indication in the documentation that we were provided of how frequently a registry is used. Without a registry, the data would not be available electronically. So the work group that reviewed this had some questions about the feasibility of implementation. There was no mention of the number of participants currently in the two registries that exist. One other question that, a couple other questions that came up in our discussion. One is that measure is based upon a guideline. However, the guideline that's cited recommends statin use based upon the level of LDL control, and the measure is measuring statin use regardless of the LDL level. Also, the numerator and denominator timeframes lack precision.
Comments from the developers?
This is Tim. I'm still on. I don't know if Lindsay can comment further. This measure is coming out of the Northern New England region. They have a number of sites, and I don't know the exact number of participants. I guess the only other thing I could comment on with reference to the guideline is, I mean, that is the existing guideline, but certainly emerging evidence has suggested that LDL level is not as important in terms of determining the benefits of statin. As you all know, a lot of times the guidelines lack a little bit behind the current state of the evidence. That is certainly, I think the use of statin without reference to LDL is certainly the current trend, and I think will be supported in future guidelines.
Other comments? Should we be prepared to vote then, Charles? Do you have any other? Okay. So if we could vote on importance to measure and report. We're not going to get past 19 here. Oh. 19 yes, 1 no. Scientific acceptability, scale of 1 to 4. Eight completely, 11 partially, 1 minimally. Usability. Fourteen completely, 5 partially, 1 minimally. Feasibility. 13 completely, 7 partially. And does the measure meet the NQF criteria? 19 yes, 1 abstain. I'm going to hand the rest of the measures to Arden. I'm not going to hand the rest of the measures to Arden. All right. So next one is HRQ, abdominal aortic aneurysm volume, 0357.
Okay, that's me. So these are a composite pair with the one that's following. Should I do them together?
Please.
Okay. So the first measure is a volume measure of AAA repair based on hospital discharge at the provider level. And the comparison, the companion measure is discharge in which a AAA repair was done, opener, endovascular, in which an in-hospital death occurred. I think that in terms of the first measure, in terms of importance, this document, there's a lot of cutting and pasting going on, and it's a little hard to interpret it in certain places. In terms of looking at the performance gap, they report the numbers of procedures done by age and race and not by provider. So I'm not sure if the person filling the form out was what they're trying to get at with that data. But we know it's a very important measure, one of the earliest measures for quality is AAA repair volume. They didn't have much in terms of disparities either. They lumped in endovascular and open repairs in this. And I'm not sure there's some comments from our group that those could be reported separately because of the trend towards open repairs happening in more complex cases now. But there may be some dipstick value to the overall discharge number that they don't really talk about that much. They have, in terms of usability in this measure, they talk about a report that was generated. There's a lot of cutting and pasting of methods of the report, but there's no data as to what the report said. So I'd like to hear more about that. And then in terms of the mortality measure, there were two risk stratification methods I read about. One was in 2A.14, which was what they used in the NIF analysis that looked at gender and age, I believe, as the only stratifying variables for mortality, probably because it's also available in HCCP. And then the other one was a CMS model that they referred to that was more detailed in terms of a model. So I wasn't clear as to what they were proposing be done for risk stratification for mortality. And then the last thing that was kind of troubling to me in the mortality measure was in section 2B3, they go through a long thing about how they define signal-to-noise ratio in their measures, and they mentioned that the mortality measure at the provider level had a low signal-to-noise ratio. So I wasn't clear if they were, and it's kind of a sentence fragment as well. Maybe it was missed, some typos in there, so it was really hard to interpret that. But it raised some alarms in my mind as well.
I also just wanted to add about the endovascular versus open repair and lumping them together, because open repairs are not what they were 10 years ago, and a lot of the literature that is quoted is from 10 years ago. Open repairs have become more complicated because the vast majority are being done endovascular, and when they're not being done endovascular, it's generally because it's a short neck, may mean a suprarenal clamp, or it's bilateral iliac artery aneurysms that are not well amenable to endovascular repair, so they are much more complicated cases than they were in the past. And also in terms of volume, there is actually a paper that just came out last year in the in circulation that looked at volume as relation to outcomes. And actually in endovasculars, the volume threshold is 10 cases per year where they started to see a difference, more or less than 10. So the volume, and it's much more dramatic in open repairs. Again, I think because open repairs have become so much more complex. So I think lumping them together is not a good thing.
Do we know what the breakdown is in the vascular versus open? I would say
probably now at least 80% are done endovascular, at least. I'm not sure if the SBS tracks that. They could probably answer that better, but I would say, I know in my own practice it's probably 80%. And those that aren't, you know, again, they're the more complicated patients anatomically.
Renee mentioned about emergencies. Almost all of those are being done open, or
It depends on the center, and it may be a reason why to take out the ruptures. Those centers that are have a process in place to do them endovascularly, tend to do them endovascularly. And when I say a process, you have to have grafts on site. You can't be waiting for a rep to come and bring you grafts. So if you don't have stock in grafts, you may not be able to do them endovascularly, unless it's a stable ruptured aneurysm. You know, somebody who presents with abdominal pain and has a rupture on CT but is not unstable. But for unstable patients, unless you're set up to do them, you're not going to be doing them. And then, of course, the open ruptures are much more disastrous than the endovascular ruptures. So again, another reason to separate them out.
This is Tim Kreisberg, and I'm not here to comment on these measures, but I will. As I discussed in the introduction to the other measures, the SVS and the people involved with quality from the SVS would not support either of these measures based on the scientific validity. Certainly the risk adjustment methodology based on either NIS or administrative claims data is far from valid. I've already alluded to the previous problems with volume, and there's been multiple studies that have shown that, certainly when you try to come up with a clear threshold, it's very problematic. I mean, the trend is there, but once you start risk adjusting, you lose a lot of the validity, if you will. And it always adds the perverse incentive, as I said, because people tend to try to meet these volume thresholds, and the only way you meet these volume thresholds is by operating on more and more patients who would be better off not having a procedure altogether. So I just would register that from the Society for Vascular Surgery point of view, we would not support these measures.
Could we hear from the HRQ?
So there are, we've actually done extensive analyses here, and there was discussion of these points as well during the original endorsement process several years ago. And there are actually strong methodologic reasons for the choices that were made here. So in terms of, for example, the increased use of endovascular procedures. So the national data, of course, lag several years behind leaders practice. The last national data that we looked at showed about 60%. Endovascular, but the trend was still upward, so it wouldn't surprise me if that was up to 75% now. But what we've seen is that as people have converted to the endovascular approach, the short-term mortality has decreased. Now, there is some argument in the literature about whether endo leaks and other long-term complications may erode some of that early benefit. But the fact is that from the patient-centered perspective, that it's important to combine the two types of procedures, because otherwise you miss the fact that there's been a temporal trend towards decreasing short-term mortality, which is largely attributable to the switchover from the open approach to the endovascular approach. So this is a specific process that has been implemented within most hospitals that has improved short-term outcomes. So when we see that, we want to give hospitals credit for that improvement. And the way to do that is by constructing the indicator in a patient-centered way so that it reflects the patients who are coming into the hospital for their AAA repair. In terms of the issue of the ruptured and the unruptured, so this is also, of course, a very important issue. I would say that the risk adjustment model, and if you're interested, I can show a copy of it, but it certainly does include, as one of the most important factors, the rupture of the aneurysm. So that is taken into consideration in the risk model. Again, putting these two types of procedures together is based on three premises. One is empirical literature showing that surgeons and hospitals' experience with ruptured cases improves outcomes for all cases and vice versa. So generally it's the same surgeons who are operating on ruptured and unruptured cases. And the experience that they accumulate basically carries over to improved outcomes for both ruptured and unruptured cases. So by combining the two together, the performance of the indicator substantially improves in terms of the reliability and the ability to discriminate amongst providers. Roughly 50% of the variation that is linked to the volume outcome association, roughly 50% of that is attributable to ruptured aneurysms, roughly 50% is attributable to unruptured aneurysms. So we see this tracking together, that the centers that have better outcomes with ruptured aneurysms also tend to have better outcomes with unruptured aneurysms. So again, this is sort of a methodologic rationale for combining the two and dealing with the obvious difference in risk through adjustments in the statistical model.
How much is ruptured weighted in your model?
So the ruptured cases constitute roughly 10% of the cases and roughly half the deaths.
Can I ask, could you comment on the notations you guys have in there about the signal quality of the mortality measure? And also, if the model that you published in the application is not the correct one, you have to see the one that you actually are going to use.
Sorry. The model is the one that's currently in use, and I'm pulling that up momentarily, but my internet is a little bit slow here. And I will look over. I'm sorry, I didn't prepare this myself, so I'll look over it and have to respond in a minute.
So the purpose of these measures is to inform the public as well as the practices. Most people don't choose their hospital for a ruptured aneurysm. Although I understand the methodology that this somewhat like a trauma center, you do a lot of ruptured aneurysms, you get good at doing that. But to inform the public about where to get your aneurysm repair, is it necessary to have that in there? I mean, we try to segregate in other measures acute cabbages, salvage cabbages and things like that have been separated out. Can't that be done here too? I mean, I don't understand why it would. I understand your methodology about tracking centers, but I don't understand why it has to be done in this measure.
Well, and I point out there is, in terms of just using volume also, there is literature now showing, and this is from Circulation 2010 by Landon et al., and they showed not really a significant difference over 10 cases for endovascular elective repairs versus open, and again, because open elective repairs are becoming more complex. And like Dr. Sima said, when you don't choose your ruptured, you don't choose the hospital where you wind up with a rupture.
Just out of clarification, for CABG, do we segregate it this way between emergency and elective?
It's in the model. There's also a lot of controversy around whether or not patients who are receiving CPR either on their way into the OR or immediately prior to going to the OR should be included. But as of right now, they're included in the model.
There are some exceptions in the sense that a salvage operation doesn't need an LAD, it doesn't need an AMRI. So there are they've taken those patients out. Those high risk emergent type patients those are out of this pool, and I can't think of anything more emergent than a person with a pre-ruptured AAA.
Can I add that this is a provider level measure according to the ARC application, and they state that the hospital level measurement is unreliable. Although the usability report they reference talks about informing policymakers about hospital quality, so that's also a little confusing.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble finding the specific section of the document that you're referring to. If you could clarify that, and I don't know if
2B3.
If the statistician and our team is on the call, Jeff Geffert. I guess not. Okay. In the meantime, I did pull up the risk adjustment model for AAA mortality, Just so that model includes gender, age categories, starting at 65 up to 85 and over. It includes ruptured versus unruptured aneurysms. It includes major diagnostic categories that reflect comorbidities, major comorbidities, and it includes, it's based on the APR-DRG risk adjustment scheme, so it includes three APR-DRGs that basically correspond to features of the aneurysm and associated cardiovascular conditions. I did, we are looking at 2B3 here. So the signal ratio is the proportion of the total variation across providers that is truly related to systematic differences in provider performance, and it's 31%, which is lower than some, but higher than others. So it was high enough to meet our threshold for inclusion, but some other indicators are in the range of 50% or over. So this is a policy debate as far as whether 30% signal is high enough.
What was the value for the weight of a rupture in your model? I mean, you put in, you cited off about a dozen different things, but the main issue here is rupture should be included or not.
Right. The point estimate in a logistic model with a C statistic of 0.909 is 1.8, so that would translate into an odds ratio of E to 1.8, or roughly 5, I'm thinking. So I think that corresponds roughly to the absolute difference of about 5% versus 30% or so. So the overall C statistic of 0.909 reflects the discrimination of the model, and that's generally considered very good for risk adjustment models based on these types of data.
Actually, I like the argument about if you're good at doing some open cases, or if you're good at doing endovascular cases, you might be good at doing emergency case. So I think Dr. Romano's point there actually, for me, had some traction, that it's good to include them. I understand that they're all kind of different, but the fact that, you know, we don't know where these cases are coming from and what those providers do, I think it sounds like it might be useful to keep them in there, the emergency cases and the open cases.
I'm not saying we shouldn't look at open, but I think there's a vast difference now between endovascular and open cases. And remember, this is publicly reported, so if I were a patient, I would rather know, if I had a complex aneurysm, I'd rather know about the volume of open than the total volume. Because maybe somebody does 100 endovasculars and 2 opens.
Because what I'm hearing is part of this,
this Nick is what about the conversion from 2 open from an endovascular? I mean, are we considering that at all as well?
No, I don't think that's considered in actually any of the measures. It's not,
yeah.
I think the rate is very low now. I remember seeing a paper about it not too long ago that the rate of conversion is under 1%.
I think
our selection criteria has gotten better.
I think what I'm hearing in this discussion is that there's an overall mortality rate for these vascular procedures. And you almost have a 2x2 matrix of open versus endovascular and elective versus ruptured. And looking at the overall and looking at the subsets, I think both have different values. I mean, if you're looking within a hospital system in terms of are you appropriately giving the right therapy to the right group of patients, you want to look at your overall numbers. Again, if you are a given patient who's faced with having an open versus an endovascular, yes, you may be interested in looking at the details. So I think maybe what we're doing is we're interested in the overall number, but realize some of the inherent weaknesses, and then maybe the stratification into those subcategories would be helpful to set this apart.
Yeah,
Jessica, this is Jeff Gipper. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, now we do. Thank you.
Sorry. just on that last point, so part of this process, starting from when the indicator was originally endorsed, were the series of communications with folks at SBS, and one of the things that are said they would do in response to the points that are being discussed is allow for the stratification of the measure in the software based on the open and the endovascular and the ruptured and the unruptured. So this kind of two-by-two stratification that you just mentioned is a component of the correct software.
So, of course, the problem with trying to stratify and have more homogeneous populations for comparisons is that the number in your cells goes down and the ability to discriminate also goes down. This is not a measure generally, nor are the pancreatic, nor are the esophageal measures that have an enormous power to discriminate providers in the first place. And so this is one of the challenges around the desire to have good outcomes measures for, these high-risk or relatively high-risk interventions on the behalf of the public, is that the aspiration for what the public wants versus what is actually realistically deliverable, or there's kind of a big gulf there. So on this one, I think I'm going to look to Melinda again. I think we should take this as a vote on importance to measure, or we should send it back for more refinement. I think that's an important discussion.
I think we were also at some point talking about harmonizing the volume and the mortality into one. And discussion of harmonization with related measures comes after the vote related to meeting the criteria, but before a vote on recommendation for endorsement.
And in this case, I would say that this volume measure and mortality measure do have the same definition, so at least these two measures are harmonized with each other. And in this case, we have done extensive analyses of these questions of looking at open versus endovascular and so forth, and I think the chair has summarized the issue very well, that we feel that the loss of reliability, the loss of discrimination in separating out half the deaths is not justified empirically. So that's our view.
This is Tim. I was going to comment on this endovascular versus open, and I think it has to be viewed in terms of where we are today versus where we were when these things were first being looked at, in that, there was, if you will, perhaps an option that people could go one way or the other. I mean, and I would have to say that in 2011, virtually nobody, if you will, is getting an open repair if they are a reasonable endovascular candidate. And so, I think these procedures really have become quite distinct. They're not the same population. The patients that are getting open repair in 2011 are ones that, have anatomic configuration that does not allow an endovascular repair. So, I think the environment has completely changed, and so I think that's got to be taken into consideration as this is viewed.
I have a question. These things are composite measures, so do you have to go the same way for both of them? Or?
No. They are recommended for use as a pair. They are endorsed individually.
Okay. Does this concern that 70% of the variance in the provider level is noise in the measure? So if you're going to use this for reporting about providers, it's a lot of noise, I think.
Although that's similar to a lot of other measures that are publicly reported, so including some of the ones that we've talked about today for pancreatic and esophageal. The other thing it's maybe a comment that's more appropriate for the public commentary, but, in order for endorsement
you know, to be a meaningful process, it has to be something on which people can rely for planning and for decision making. And you know, this has been a long 3-year process from when the measures were originally endorsed to the point now where, you know, they're scheduled to be included in a hospital compare. And there's been, you know, publications in the notices in the Federal Register, you know, public comments to the Federal Register notices, several rounds of hospital, you know, reports that have gone out for possible comments, and this has been a several year process. And so to change a decision based on a lot of, you know, and it's in the last point about that there has been trends in the last couple of years that, you know, maybe merit reconsideration, but, you know, to make a decision based on a lot of factors that have been previously considered, were discussed with people like SPS, you know, in some sense it really pulls the rug out of a process that, you know, the federal government has spent a lot of money and time and effort on. And so it's just something that should weigh very heavily, in my opinion.
So what exactly are we doing here then?
The body language around the table did not receive that one well, since you're on the phone and can't see it. I think justifying the continuance of a bad measure because a lot has been invested in it is not a very compelling argument.
That's why I said it's probably more appropriate for the general comment period. But...
I kind of liked Alan's idea about looking at this on overall, all the individual ones. Is really what you're talking about here is the care of the patient with an abdominal aortic aneurysm, whether it be open, where you have some anatomy that drives that decision, or it's EVR, or if it's emergent. I think all of them should be included. You know, you have the overall, and you'll, because these generally don't occur in isolation. You don't just do opens, and you just don't do EVARs, and you just don't do emergence, right?
I understand that, but to report them as one lump, I think, does disservice to the differences between them. And if you're going to make judgments based on lumping them all together, you're not going to get a correct judgment.
So I think we've covered the pros and cons here pretty well, and I guess I think the logical place to go is to a vote unless somebody asserts otherwise. Okay, so let's first answer, does the measure meet NQF criteria for importance to measure and report?
Are you voting on 357?
Yes, 357. So it's a dead heat, 10 to 10.
You want me to braise it? Next year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well let's continue through the remaining portions of the vote. Ah, Dr. Sears, can you break the tie?
Yeah, I would say no.
Okay. Eileen is also on the call?
I am.
Would you care to vote yes or no?
I'm actually going to have to abstain.
You're going to abstain. Okay. So do we proceed with the remainder of the vote, Melinda? Too tight? So we want...
I'm looking at Helen because she's got the better... It's so clearly a split vote, it's hard to argue for consensus on that first vote. So I think either have more discussion or see if there's additional information you want to get from ARC and discuss on a subsequent call. But to just table it at this point seems a little, doesn't sit right. So some of the discussion was around the question of having it split and having open versus endovascular
So are there some conditions or requests that the group has of ARC to bring information back to reconsider it?
And if I might say it in the context that the current measure and software does support stratification, so that is an option that's available to users. What could be done that's not currently done is separate risk adjustment models could be developed for the different cells in that 2x2 table.
Well, I mean, that's one option, but I mean, I think the general consensus is people are viewing these as two very distinct procedures now. And that if you're doing EVAR, you should have a mortality rate of X. And if you're doing opens, you should have a mortality rate of Y. I don't
if you want to tie, well, and if you want to tie blind to them, you can tie blind to them. I'm not a big fan of lying these days.
But I'm just saying, could that be, rather than stratify them, just have them separate? And because I know in our health system, all the open ones come to our institution. All the surrounding hospitals no longer do them. And so it's sort of strange, you know, and all the ruptures come to us. So we're, you know, we get the worst of both worlds because no one touches them. And so that's the reality. And so, and I think we're comparing apples and oranges. But as a surgeon in the room, I deal with totally different patient populations and totally different procedures.
And as a vascular surgeon, I concur with that. This measure is the volume measure, and if 75% or so of the cases are endovascular, the numbers are so small on volume anyway. If you separate out, it seems like for the open procedures, there's not even enough left to report on volume. So in terms of this measure, 357, which is volume, does it make sense to make it just endovascular?
No, again, if you look at the last paper that came out from Circulation, the volume effect on mortality for endovascular is very small. The threshold where they saw the biggest difference was more or less than 10 surgeries a year. So the volume effect is very small. The volume effect is much higher for opens. So I think it would actually, even though their opens happen less frequently, they have become so much more complex that I think it's still reasonable to look at that volume. That's where you really see the differences in volume. And each quartile, the mortality goes down with the number of volume that you do.
But looking at the data in the volume measure, the 10 cases, and this is combining open and endovascular, 10 cases comes between the second and third quartile. So you have an awful lot of facilities doing less than 10 no matter how you count it.
So
the second quartile is 5.6, the third quartile is 13.8, and 2F3.
So I think it is worth pointing out that this is in fact just the volume vote, and we also need to look at the mortality rate vote. But I guess I would absorb from the discussion that a reasonable charge for the developers would be to come back with a model that separates endovascular from open. For both volume and for repair in the absence of another suggestion.
I will also mention that there are papers out there, actually one written recently by my colleague down in Tucson, Joe Mills, where their mortality rates, although they didn't hit thresholds, were equal to the ones at higher volume hospitals. So at one point we discussed this with some of the other cases, it's the process rather than just the volume.
So we're certainly able to report back on the implications of separating the volume according to open versus endovascular and reporting those separately.
And I suggest also the mortality. We could go through the exercise of voting on mortality as well, but should we do that, Melinda? Do you suggest we do?
Yes.
It is the same.
Okay, this year probably not.
Right. So it. No, and we get the additional information based on what you've just requested, and then reconsider the two of them at that time.
For mortality, there is a more explicit trade-off with loss of reliability and loss of discrimination associated with reporting those outcomes separately. So we can try to estimate that. There was already some concern about the signal-to-noise ratio being a bit on the low side at 30%, so I would expect that would further decrease when we split the measures. Again, the other thing is from the consumer's perspective, of course, the consumer's not making the choice about what type of procedure to have, so I'm not sure that argument is often made that when there's a choice that's made by the surgeon as far as the particular technique, that's not appropriate for public reporting because it's not the consumer's choice.
This is Tim Kreisberg, and I guess I'd have to disagree with the idea that the consumers aren't making this choice. In reality, as I said before, consumers want an endovascular repair if it's feasible. So in a sense, the decision is really, yes, it is a surgeon decision, but to be based on the technical characteristics of the aneurysm and whether it's feasible or not. I'd just like to, and add one more thing in this discussion, and I would urge Art to do this too. I think there's an awful lot of focus on statistically significant differences in thresholds and not enough on clinically significant differences. In other words, having reviewed a number of these volume outcome studies, when you look at, a threshold is picked that because it meets some statistical difference, when in fact the difference between two, volume groups are the difference between 2% mortality and 3% mortality, or even 2.5 and 3%, I think that has to be taken into consideration before too much stock is put on a study that suggests that there is a statistically significant difference, when in fact the clinical differences in terms of mortality are minimal. So I would urge the group just to consider all those factors when they look at the data supporting these. Thank you.
Thank you. So let's move on from these two measures and go to 1523. In-hospital mortality following elective open repair.
I'm going to do these together because it's the EVAR one and the open one are very similar. So as presented by the sponsors previously, the reason they chose to look at small asymptomatic aneurysms is because from many studies, the threshold for operating on aneurysms is 5.5, and that's based on the rupture risk versus risk of surgery. For women, it's slightly smaller than men, and that's why they chose the thresholds that they did. When you're operating on a smaller aneurysm, there are reasons to operate, growth rates, quote, symptoms, although they're not ruptured, and there are some studies that suggest that smaller aneurysms in certain subset of patients, such as patients with poorly controlled hypertension and COPD, rupture at smaller rates. So those are the reasons to operate on smaller aneurysms. But if you're going to do that, you have to make sure that your mortality is also low. And as suggested by the sponsors, that means that you have to have done some kind of risk stratification before you even perform the surgery, and thus it should be implicit that you have already done that and the patients are pre-risk stratified. And that's why they felt they should just look at those patient populations. The comments that came up during the discussion of this procedure is the in-hospital mortality versus a 30-day mortality for both measures. Particularly came up with the endovascular, because a lot of endovascular patients are home within 48 hours. And as with the discussion earlier with the ambulatory surgery centers, your responsibility doesn't end when the patient leaves the door. And so there was a lot of discussion about asking the sponsors if they can make it a 30-day mortality instead of just an in-hospital mortality.
Other comments? Could the developers respond to that request?
Certainly. And again, the intent, I should say, the long-range intent with these measures is to make them universally applicable in terms of being able to capture the data with administrative, capture the outcomes anyway with administrative data alone. And that's the real problem with 30 days, is that obviously that's the standard, that's ideal, but it requires clear participation in some sort of, if you will, prospective follow-up with calls, with all those things that obviously are the ideal, but are likely never to be universally applicable. So that's the reason for focusing on the in-hospital mortality. I certainly would say that in both cases, regardless of the discharge within 48 hours for endovascular, you still are picking up the vast majority of adverse outcomes. And it's you know, just based on numerous studies, that ratio between what happens within the hospital versus the 30 days is pretty consistent. So they do track very well together, and it's certainly our belief that the trade-off in terms of applicability of the hospital mortality versus the 30-day is well worth it in terms of the, you know, the burden of data collection and the applicability. Thank you.
Some of the comments were that since many folks are using NISQIP, that the data could be picked up that way or some other registry, especially with our earlier, I don't think you were on the phone call earlier, but there is a measure out there to look at the percentage of people participating in some kind of multi-center database.
Absolutely. I mean, that's where it's got to start. And, you know, there, obviously I'm actually the clinical lead for NISQIP in our institution. It does not currently capture aneurysm size. But I would say, you know, yes, there is NISQIP out there, but it's certainly not widespread in terms of the entire country. So again, in order to move eventually to something that could truly be publicly reported at every single institution, that's the reason to kind of design it the way it has been at this point. And just so people understand, part of the intent is to try to create, and I hope everybody's familiar with CPT-2 codes that would allow the aneurysm size to be reported administratively. And that would be the long-term goal for this set of measures. Again, to allow universal applicability.
The comments that are coming up here is then why not a 30-day mortality code?
Again, it depends on what your ultimate goal is. See, the beauty is if you can, if you're still requiring on some sort of voluntary participation in reporting, and even though that is a laudable goal, we're clearly, if you look nationally, you know, very far from that. The opportunity here is again to be able to use existing administrative data that would not require any participation on the part of the provider once you have this aneurysm size as a criteria. I'll share sort of the possibilities for the future is that you could in fact
if you don't get the kind of reporting that you want, eventually say that the assumption is that if you're not reporting this as a larger aneurysm greater than the threshold, the assumption will be that it's within that threshold. So again, the idea is to finally get to the point where we can have valid comparison data. We just went through a discussion about all the problems with the ARC measures that are existing out there, and this would be something that I think could actually get us to something that would be scientifically and clinically accepted by the surgical community, and get to what we really want, which is real outcome data that patients and others could use. I would also say that, you know, the beauty of these measures too is you can eliminate the volume threshold issue. If you're only doing a few aneurysms a year, you best have a 0% mortality, or else you're going to look pretty bad. So you don't have to, with this kind of approach, you can, if you will, you still have a volume incentive, but it becomes one where if you're really a low-volume provider, you almost have to have a 0% mortality, or you're at least going to be identified, if you will. So I think, some of the advantages of this approach. But again, there's no problem with the 30-day other than it really limits the universal applicability down the road.
Piece of fine print is that the time frames, again, are written very confusingly. We're talking about that it's in hospital, but that's not what the document says. But my real question is, the denominator description for these includes people with small aneurysms, but the data that's reported includes people with larger aneurysms. And I'm just trying to understand where the data comes from if the measure only includes people with small aneurysms. Is this totally separate data?
Small is not, I mean, it's a difficult area to try to characterize. The intent with the threshold here were to, if you will, exclude from the denominator patients with large aneurysms. And that's probably a better way to look at it. The idea being that, you know, and again, where you draw that exact line, the data certainly supports that observation is reasonable, is a reasonable alternative for men with 5.5 centimeter or less aneurysms and women with 5.0 centimeter and less aneurysms. Again, because of less limited data, the validity of that 5 for women is a little bit less robust. But in any way, so it's clearly safe to observe those patients. And on the other hand, we clearly know that someone that comes in with a 10 centimeter aneurysm, which we all see, even if they do have significant comorbidity, that the high rupture rate of that in the short term may justify intervention. So the intent really was to exclude from the denominator aneurysms for which this concept of risk adjustment on the part of the surgeon weighing the risks and benefits becomes less important by excluding those. So that's the intent, not to really identify the you know, the term small, if you will.
Okay, no, I understand that, and that's how your denominator is defined. But in 2D5, in the testing results, there's results provided for men with aneurysms larger than 6 centimeters and women with aneurysms larger than 5.5 centimeters. And I wasn't sure where that data would come from in this measure because those people should have been excluded according to the denominator definition.
And I'm sorry, but that was supposed to be the denominator definition, and if there's an error in the submission, the denominator definition was supposed to be 6 centimeters or less for men and 5.5 or less for women. That would be the denominator inclusion criteria.
And that is what's in the description, but then the data that's presented is different than that, and so I'm not sure when the sample sizes are given. Do the sample sizes include people with
the aneurysms that are larger than those criteria. Now, I'm not sure how to interpret the data, because the data that are presented, both in terms of sample size and results, include larger aneurysms than are included in the denominator.
That data that you're looking at is the volume data. And I think what he was trying to say is that they don't want to use the volume data. They want to make it an easy ability. The data that is evidence for smaller aneurysms having less structural risk of harm. A couple of very large studies, one out of the UK, that looked at following aneurysms. They basically followed aneurysms and saw what the rupture rates were. But that is not the data that you're looking at right now. That was just mortality by volume. That's actually the ARC data.
But are these the results? I guess I'm really confused now. I thought the results in 2D5 were the results of the indicator that's being described. Are the results in 2D5 the results of something else? That's what I'm trying to understand.
I'm trying to catch up with you here. I'm sorry. So which measure are we talking about?
I think it disposes of them because they have the same background data applied in both. If you look at 2D5.
Can you give me about 1523?
2D5 says refinement of the HCUP quality indicators. They're essentially using the ARC data, but I think that's not really the background for this study. This is the ARC indicator, rather.
So then if we don't know the sample size and we don't know the results, are we even in a position to make a decision?
I'm looking at, I think I'm caught up with you now. So this is, the testing results was done by the Northern New England group, okay? And so they're quoting what the actual mortality was in the thresholds that we described. So those should be the same thresholds that are in the measure. If there's not, there's an error. So we are talking about that this is not ARC data. This is actual data from the Northern New England Vascular Registry.
Okay, so if we're looking at 1523 then, in 2D3, it describes 1,201 patients. Is it 1,201 patients with aneurysms of all sizes, or is it 1,201 with aneurysms below the size we're describing? And it makes a difference, because are the data on the smaller aneurysms, is it based on 100 patients or 1,000 patients? Don't know if it includes both.
I see what you're saying. The whole sample is all patients undergoing open elective repair. I'm sorry, I don't have the breakdown. I was not part of that testing group. I can't answer the question because I don't have the testing data. I would assume, okay, just based on other studies, that the vast majority of the patients are going to fall into the what we call, and I don't like this term either, the small volume, so the less than 6 centimeters of men and less than 5.5 centimeters of women. Those are the vast majority of patients being done. I assume that's the same for Northern New England, but I just don't have the exact numbers. I'm sure that could be provided for you, though.
And partly it makes a difference, I think, even in terms of the relevance of the measure, because this is 7 years of data for about 10 centers. And if there's only 1,200 patients over 7 years, and if some of those 1,200 patients don't even belong in the measure because they have larger aneurysms, again, I'm not that affects the relevance for me.
The relevance and the scientific evidence for the volume threshold is based on large trials. This section we're talking about here is only a testing of the measure, more focused on feasibility. I think we're talking about two separate issues. This has nothing to do with the scientific evidence behind the measure or the choice of volume threshold. This was just, again, to meet the NQF criteria that measures for endorsement have to be tested in some way.
So they, and just to show that, you know, you can collect the measure, it's feasible, but that's quite a different question from the scientific validity.
I also, you're talking about importance. Okay, the importance is that, as the sponsor just indicated, there's a lot of people getting done at smaller aneurysm size. There is evidence that says you don't have to operate on everybody with a smaller aneurysm. Many of them stay the same and can be watched and may never need an operation. So it's important because you want to make sure that people who are getting operations are really the correct people. And that people are making the right choices in operating on those patients. So if you have a, you know, 5% mortality in a small aneurysm patient, well, that's actually higher than or equal to their rupture risk.
No, and I understand that. But if a center is doing 10 cases in 10 years, the meaningfulness of the measure, I think, is limited. And again, I don't know because I don't know what the numbers are here.
Can I just take you through that a little bit? Because I'm confused by that. But if a center is doing, let's say they're doing 10 cases a year, and if three of those patients have mortality, and in this measure you pick that up, that's a 30% mortality, which would certainly be something that I would think people would want to know. And the point of this is, if you're talking about this population, this should be one that should have a extremely low mortality in order to be, a justified operation in the first place. So I think this is important and it is very relevant regardless of the numbers that are being performed.
Right. Except for when you get very small numbers, there's just such year-to-year variation, it's really hard to draw conclusions or take action. You know, if an average, you know, if you have one complication this year and then none for 5 years, you know, if the numbers are small, it can just cause such variation from year to year. It's hard to interpret.
I think it's similar to what we were talking about with the ambulatory surgery center. So if you've been, you know, had a 0.2% mortality and then all of a sudden the next year you have a 30% mortality, it may make you go back and look at your process. Or, you know, did you get somebody who's, you know, is it just, you can't blame everything on the patient, so you have to go back and look at your process if you suddenly have a spike in your mortality.
I guess the point here, it gets back to the study that shows that zero mortality is predictive only of low volume, that it in fact predicts average to high mortality in subsequent years in surgical patients. And so the whole notion of, you know, when is low volume too low is tough. This seems like a very innovative measure in the sense that it, I think, very concisely pares down this complex issue of risk adjustment using administrative data. So it's a very intriguing measure. It's potentially got applicability in a lot of other surgical areas, I would guess. These concerns about numbers notwithstanding, I guess the question that seemed obvious to me at first and now seems less obvious is, right now, do you actually have, and I'm asking the developer, do you actually have a way of identifying the small aneurysms in administrative data? And if not, how are you going to do it?
No. And that's the, you know, the reason why this is being limited at the current time to a registry that would include that variable. The Northern New England Registry does include aneurysm size as one of their data points.
Well, could I ask, then, does the Northern New England Registry include 30-day mortality?
They do. Again, maybe it's better to just discuss the whole history of this. This measure, or this group of measures, was originally proposed to go forward as a non-registry measure. You're up against, and this is a problem with NQF right now, is you've got this whole concept of testing. Well, you run into the feasibility of how do you test something without creating a way for testing. So we've got the CPT-2 code to allow this are working their way through the CPT-2 it's called PMAG, so that group. We've also had discussions with CMS about, because you need to partner, if you're going to do this with administrative data, you need somebody that has that administrative data. So that's all part of the long-term strategy, but in order to get these considered so that it can lead this whole discussion, and I think you just made a very important point, is this could have applicability in so many other surgical areas. It's sort of what we've all been looking for, is a way to get real outcome data without a tremendous burden of data collection. But so all those processes are in place. The reason they're here before this panel today is to start getting this concept out there, and it is currently feasible to do within a registry that would collect this data. But this is only the stepping stone, if you will, to hopefully a bigger picture.
Could I suggest, though, that when you do this in the registry, assuming we vote it up, that you do the 30-day mortality in addition to the in-hospital mortality, just to establish the credibility of your assertion that all the deaths occur by and large in the hospital?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is the Northern New England does collect the 30-day mortality. And this was just sort of a, that's why I went through the history a little bit. This was originally designed, and we had hoped to go forward with the bigger picture in mind, but then as it got pared down, if you will, to just the registry. But the Northern New England does collect that data at any point.
Great.
I'm a little confused now.
Me too.
What are we voting on in the sense of, do you have to be a member of the SCS? I mean, this is like the discussion we had with the SCS the last meeting and this morning. You know, I was going through here, and it's talking about New England and the SCS. You have to be a member of a registry, it says. So we've already... So is this a pilot, or is this for the whole country to do it? Because the SCS covers 95% of the cardiac surgeons, they said, in the country. What's the SCS cover in the registry?
I think the registry in this case is in NNE, which is 10 hospitals.
There's actually an SBS registry that has started in the last, I think, year and a half that people are starting to participate in. So there is a growing SBS registry, but it's nowhere, it's kind of in its infancy. However, if the CPT-2 codes go through, I mean, and notwithstanding the sponsor's concern about 30 days, I can't believe that it's that hard to collect 30-day mortality, because I think most hospitals and places are tracking that now. But, you know, it's either all you need to, the only additional information you need is the size of the aneurysm and a threshold. So once you have above or below that threshold in the CPT code, and then you have a 30-day mortality, it's a yes-no question, alive or dead. So it should be fairly easy for anybody to do once those CPT codes are through.
Yeah, and I think there's no question that I'll try to answer the question about whether it's a pilot or not. The original intent was to have this go forward more as to get this concept endorsed so that further, if you will, implementation strategy could go on. But we do have the ability to do this right now within the registry. The SBS registry right now is primarily the carotid registry, so it's applicable to those two measures, which are related, but that's not what we're talking about right now. The Northern New England registry, and again, I don't have the, there's 12, 13 institutions. They basically cover most of Northern New England, and so that is ongoing. The only reason that you were talking about this as a registry-only measure is because that's the only way we could get this to this level at this point in time. That was an NQF decision. There were multiple phone calls and discussions that was suggested that to go this route. Because right now there are a number of groups out there like this one with, I think, a creative approach, but you're blocked by, you can't get the measure tested until you get it endorsed. You can't endorse it until it's tested. So it's kind of a catch-22 that many groups are in. So this is an attempt to try to get the concept, which can be, it is feasible to do within the registry setting, but this is just the short term. I hope it didn't add more confusion.
Yeah,
I just want to clarify one point. We're talking about a measure that we can only obtain through a registry because you need the anatomic data about the size of the aneurysm. And we currently don't have a registry other than the 10 hospital group.
You could get that data because every, operation somewhere, you have a CAT scan that has the size of the aneurysm, so you could get that data, but it would be more laborious to do that if you don't have an easy way to do it, which is, it sounds like why they were trying to create the CPT-2 codes. So the question would come up is, how far along are those CPT-2 codes to make this a universally applicable measure?
And the other thing is, the measure is written very specifically in terms of being based on registry data. Switching to CPT-2 codes is dandy, but it's not what this measure is.
Can the staff tell us what's going on here? I mean, we've never had one that was just for 10 hospitals. So why are we voting on this? We're supposed to be here to do an overall thing, right, for the country.
So let's step back for a second and just talk in general, because this applies to both the measures that come from FCS as well as these. They're specified using registry data. As they're written, they're not specifically calling out any specific registry and tying it to that. They just happen to be using data to support for testing and to show use with FCS and also with New England and the FCS registry. So any measure you have before you that uses registry data can be used by anyone who has a registry, assuming they are in that field. Helen, do you have anything to add? I mean,
the only thing I would add is that they could, even the registry measures we have already endorsed have sufficient specifications in them that anyone could take them and apply them during a chart review in your hospital or whatever the case may be, and then look towards the benchmark and see where you are, because we are trying to get to national metrics. So I guess the question would be, as this is written, can you take this with the specifications in this form, test it on a registry, which is fine, that's not an issue for us, and actually use it in a widespread national scale?
I actually don't need, in my mind, you wouldn't even need a registry because there's only two data points that you need. You need above and below a certain size, and you need alive or dead at whatever time point you say. So if you say 30-day time point, I mean, you can get that from a chart review. So in my mind, you don't need a registry to have this be a measure.
You may not need it, but then the measure needs to be rewritten because the measure is defined in terms of a registry.
Then the same thing applies to all the SCS ones we looked at.
Actually, those are generally written as a real numerator and a denominator, not specifically tied to the registry. I mean, they are elements within the FCS registry, but...
A registry that includes. And then it goes on to specify the Society of Vascular Surgeons Quality Registry and the Vascular Surgeons Group have such information. So either you change the wording...
They say any registry, though. But
it does specify two registries. I'm not disagreeing with the two points you did. I'm just saying, Melinda has said multiple times, we vote on what's written in front of us. And what's written in front of us, the way it's worded, says you using these registries.
It actually, I don't think it says that.
I don't think it says that either.
It says under 2A3, it specifically says that the numerator details is a registry that includes hospitalization details, so that probably needs to be...
But it says what the registry includes. It doesn't say this registry. It's got to be a registry that includes those elements.
I think it could be easily reworded and taken care of. Yeah.
Not clear.
Okay, so my head is spinning, to put it mildly.
Mine too.
And let me see if I can put together where we stand on these two measures, which are obviously more or less one and the same, except for the method of repair. We need to allow activity to occur to move this forward. On the other hand, the way that this is exactly specified doesn't seem to move it forward very much in terms of having a significant impact on a lot of patients at a lot of institutions. But this is you know, this is definitely a baby that I think we want to nurture. So the question is, how do we nurture this this measure in a constructive way, staying within our pretty pretty constrained rule set?
And this could be heresy, but one of the ways that it could be nurtured is by continued implementation and bringing it to be considered for endorsement at a point after some of the questions that have been raised have been answered in the application of the measure.
So does that mean we just don't vote at all?
I don't think so. I think okay. The group has to vote in terms of whether or not they believe that at this point in time the measure is matured, tested, and can be appropriately applied on a national basis. And I'm looking in the direction of my partners and Brian here.
And then just hold off on the final vote, on the last vote.
Well, in terms of the vote for endorsement, we're going to hold off on it anyway.
We will not at this point vote on endorsement. We vote on the extent to which it meets each of the criteria.
Sounds good to me. Everybody have that? We're going to vote on the criteria, but not on endorsement. So 1-5-2-3, yes, no, important to measure. Eighteen yes, three no. Scientific acceptability of measure properties, 1-4. Two completely, 16 partially, two minimally, one not at all. To meet N2F criteria for usability, 1-4. Four completely, 11 partially, four minimally, two not at all. N2F criteria for feasibility. Completely, 10 partially, 3 minimally, 4 not at all. And we will abstain on voting on endorsement.
This is, the next vote is...
That vote is whether we agree that it meets all the criteria. That was what the next vote would be. It's whether it meets the criteria for endorsement, not...
Okay, so we should have that vote then?
Yes.
Okay, does it meet all the N2F criteria for endorsement? Nine yes, 11 no, one abstain. Okay, should we go on to the endovascular?
Can I just ask, I wasn't certain what we were expected to get back with. Is that going to be clarified at some point? I thought that prior to that discussion there was something the developer needed to provide. Can somebody clarify that at a later point?
So I think it sounded like, and I can be corrected, but it sounded like one was rewording what your denominator is to not make sound to make make it sound like it's so specific to the surgery, the vascular surgery registry. Two is the 30-day mortality issue. And, I don't know, what was the other thing? Providing data that gives results for the measure, including the denominator and what the numbers are. You know, what the sample size is of the population for the facilities being measured. But real data that exactly measures what's in the measure.
And for all of the measures, we will send information back to the developers about the additional information that the group is requesting. So we'll get it back to you also written.
Thank you.
I think some notion as to what the time course might be on the CPT-2 code as well was raised. So let's follow through now and vote on EVAR. It'll be interesting to see how these correlate, if everyone can remember how they voted on the first one. Importance to measure. Yes. Scientific acceptability. 5 completely, 13 partially, 3 minimally. Usability. Completely, 15 partially, 2 minimally, 1 not at all. Feasibility. Can't seem to get that 21st one in. Five completely, 10 partially, 5 minimally, 1 not at all. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Yes, 12 no. So I would suggest we're at the time for our break. So should we break now and pick up these right where we are?
This is Nick Sears. I have a time constraint. I have to leave the airport in about 35 minutes.
If we just have the carotid ones, do you think we can deal with those? Because I don't think the discussion should not be substantially different than the one we just had.
Okay, I thought you were going to say it should be short.
There shouldn't be any new discussion.
But okay, so, well, let's see. So we have these three remaining vascular surgery measures. Can people take trying to knock those off before the break so that we can... Okay, so let's do 1548. This is the surveillance one first. And who's commenting on this?
This is Eileen Kennedy.
Hi.
I'm going to do this one. Hi. Okay, so measure 1548, surveillance after EDR, and as stated previously by the sponsor, this measure calls for one follow-up imaging study after 3 months and within 15 months of the repair.
It's important to note that there's a risk of potential failure of immigrant therapy with problems leading to potential rupture and increased mortality. These complications may be identified during optimal surveillance with imaging scans. And there were opportunities for improvement identified within the measure material. The measure does not require risk adjustment. The work group was divided on the degree to which this measure meets the scientific acceptability criteria. It was noted there are currently the two registries that are used to record the surgical details of the EBR procedures. However, the team raised a similar question to that of the previous measures to the requirement of membership in these registries in order to collect the surveillance data. There was also an additional observation made on the potential socioeconomic impact of patients not complying with the required follow-up due to the cost of the scans or necessary travel. And then the final issue that was raised was just around the use of this measure for public reporting.
Any other discussion?
You know, I think the most, the issue of public reporting was one of the major issues we discussed, because, what does this mean? So, because there are so many reasons why a patient may not have a CAT scan, and the idea thing is that you have to have some kind of follow-up for your endovascular repairs, because there are various types of endoleaks that occur, and some of them may lead to rupture. As stated by the sponsor, the exact timing is kind of still being a little bit debated in the literature, and also what kind of imaging modality you need to do as ultrasound becomes better, because it's a lot of the sort of original standard was x-rays and CTs, which is an awful lot of radiation over time. And so it wasn't quite clear how this would be used and in what manner it would be used and what its importance would be.
So let me just clarify a couple of things. The numerator for this is not CT scans. It's any imaging modality which would include duplex. I can say that, as I tried to say before, even though there is some controversy or question about what is the ideal post-procedure imaging strategy, anything that's out there right now would suggest that this is at the floor, okay? So anything less than this would not be possibly acceptable. And, you know, the problem is you've got to start somewhere. I think you would get into more controversy if you tried to have a more aggressive imaging strategy than this, but I don't think there's anybody or any evidence that would support anything less than this measure. So this should be looked at as an absolute floor, and it does not specify any particular imaging modality. So duplex ultrasound, which avoids the radiation risk, would meet this measure.
And what was the what is the public reporting of this going to be? How do you see that being realized?
I guess I don't see it any different than any other process measure. It's a process measure, just like the lots of process measures that are out there. It has the same purpose. I mean, the ultimate purpose is to get people to do the right thing. I guess I would view it as any other process measure.
And how is this data acquired outside of our registry?
Well, I mean, again, I don't want to reopen the whole box we just went through, but it was because of the limitations of getting it to this point, it had to be constrained within a registry format. It does not, as was said before, does not require the specific registries that were cited to support the measure, but clearly this data could be done simply with administrative claims, but we couldn't test it except with what we had in the registry format. So I hope I haven't added the confusion.
again, but this is just the advice and the limitations of the current process getting it to this point.
No, I think we get that. Any other discussion?
Most of these records happen after 6 months. They don't happen early. Is that right?
Yeah, for the most part. And they're actually relative, rupture is actually relatively rare, but endoleaths are not.
And imaging happens after 6 months, that's right.
Different people have different criteria. Some people image at 3 months. Some people image at 6 months. It also may depend on how comfortable you were with your repair at the time of the procedure. Was it something that was, like, was it an angulated neck with a risk of an endoleak is higher? You know, did you see an endoleak, a type 2 endoleak at the end of the case? So there might be other things that would promote you to have an earlier rather than a later imaging. But he is correct that anything longer than this would really be unacceptable in any endovascular repair.
Can you clarify for me the process of a patient has a procedure at one institution and has a long-term follow-up in a remote state or country, how that's dealt with?
Well, and again, the idea is that whoever, if you're looking at this in a registry, you would be required to know that. You're still the responsible person. How it would act in reality, this is not uncommon. Let's say a patient had it done in another state, but it would still be, and this happens even within a state, where you might have the study done elsewhere, but you would be, the surgeon would be responsible to find out what the results of that information were. So you would have that available to you regardless of where the follow-up occurred. So this would put the onus on the surgeon, if you will, to know that that study's been done, and have the information as to the results of that study.
Okay, let's vote on this and then try to get the last two in on carotid.
Before we vote, Ashley, could I add one more thing? So our issue with registry inclusion exists with this measure as well in the numerator. I just want to make sure that everybody's aware of that.
Agreed. Importance to measure, yes or no? Anyone yes, one no. Scientific acceptability, scale of 1 to 4. Three completely, 15 partially, 3 minimally. Usability. Three completely, 15 partially, 3 minimally. Feasibility. One's not in, keep pushing. Three completely, 11 partially, 5 minimally, 2 not at all. Does the measure meet all the intuitive criteria? Question. 5 yes, 15 no, 1 abstain. Thanks. So I think the message on that measure is very similar, as was pointed out, to the prior two, in that this confusion around registry versus something that's aimed for a broad use is one issue, and then the second issue is how short of a registry will the follow-up information ever be obtainable? It seems by definition almost that it will only be via registry. So let's handle 1540 and 1543 together. Nick?
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. I think we're going to have the same discussion. 1540 is post-operative stroke or death in asymptomatic patients undergoing a carotid endarterectomy. And 1543 is post-operative stroke or death in asymptomatic patients undergoing carotid artery stenting. Our group felt, everyone felt that it was a readable measure from a measuring standpoint. Some of the issues coming up in, and I think we heard from the cardiovascular surgery what the definition of asymptomatic was. I think a couple of questions were raised around how do you document somebody's asymptomatic, who is it CPT references or close, or how can that be documented? I think that's a fair question. Given the fact that patients don't necessarily see the same doctor over and over again. But both measures, other than that, that scientific reliability. Or the number three, efficiency, we didn't have a whole lot of discussion there. Again, public reporting and the other registry issue came up. So overall, I think most people felt that these were reasonable measures.
I would say that the asymptomatic is actually easy with ICD-9 codes, since you have to report them together with your surgical code as to why you're doing the procedure, and it's either a symptomatic or an asymptomatic carotid.
Okay. Well, that should take care of that problem then.
Although I think you'd want to test that to see, ICD-9 codes don't always correlate with the medical record. So I think, don't know without looking.
Yeah, and I'd love to say, yeah, that fixes the problem. Unfortunately, the current administrative data doesn't really capture this. So it's like the discussion before. The intent is to actually get this definition in the form of CPT-2 code. That process is underway. But for the purpose of what you're dealing with today, is that definition is part of the existing registries, not only the Northern New England, but also the SCS carotid registry. There's multiple other registries dealing with carotid disease out there. I wish I could say all the definitions are identical. They're not, but unless you go forward with this kind of process of trying to get there, we do need to get a common definition. But it is possible to do, we still need to ultimately get to standardization or harmonization of the definition, and that would be intent ultimately of the CPT Category 2 code.
Okay. Other comments?
Well, even CPT 2 codes are a good goal for the long term. We see in our claims almost no CPT-2 codes being used currently. So it's a good goal, it's a direction to work, but until they're used consistently, they're not necessarily useful for measurement.
I would say also, though, by using codes, you can say that for any of the measures we're looking at. Codes can always be inaccurate, but when you are charging for your surgery, you have to put a diagnosis code. So I guess what I'm saying is you'll have to trust that the surgeons are accurate, whoever's doing the procedure is accurate in terms of are they doing it for a symptomatic or an asymptomatic patient.
It seems to me that this is part of where testing the measure comes in and looking at the adequacy of testing, whether or not you're measuring what you think you're measuring, which if this vote goes like the previous votes, and SES comes back to us, maybe that's something that they could also include in what they bring back.
How accurate the codes are, you mean?
Right. Since they have registry data available, they can compare.
Any other comments?
Like with the smaller aneurysms, I think these measures are important in that if you're up to get benefit from an asymptomatic carotid, you have to live for 5 years. And your risk of your procedure has to be about 1 to 3% or less, probably closer to 1. So if you're doing the procedure, you better have good results for an asymptomatic patient because it's essentially a prophylactic surgery.
Could I ask the developer, what percentage of the carotid stents are done by vascular surgeons versus interventional radiologists versus cardiologists, and what are the sort of registry and coding practices of those other specialties? Are they similar or are they very disparate?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. It's a continued evolution, it's an unanswerable question, I think, at this point.
Excuse me, there are some data on that. It's about a third and a third and a third. Yeah, hi, I'm Skip Anderson. I'm a cardiologist with the ACC. And we reviewed that material last fall, and it's for performance of procedures, carotid stenting procedures, it's about a third done by vascular surgeons, about a third by radiologists, and about a third by cardiologists.
I guess I would suggest to our colleague from the Society of Vascular Surgery that it's really important that the measure for carotid artery stenting be developed in conjunction with those other specialties. I would think that's pretty critical from the standpoint of the NQF endorsing them.
Yeah, and we've had those discussions previously. I mean, those discussions about this measure have occurred.
I would agree. It's Renee Shepherd. I would agree with that because looking at the two measures, the level of analysis is different. So for the carotid endarterectomy, the level of analysis is at the clinician group level. And for the stenting, it's at the facility and agency level, and that doesn't make any sense to me.
I thought it was at both levels. I thought they measured lifetime for the surgeon and annual for the hospital.
It's hard to tell. Yeah, looking at least what the summary that we received from the NQF, the level of analysis is different for the two of them. I haven't gone to the specific document.
They shouldn't be, but if it is, it's an error.
The only other question I had, because I don't do stenting, was is there any risk for the people who do stent in following patients longer than 30 days? Can the stent dislodge or do what the abdominal stents do? So the 30-day numerate a number may be off for the stent. I don't know the answer to that.
In both cases, yes, there can be late complications. They're not substantially different in the studies that have been done in comparison. The kind of long-term outcomes are pretty similar. There, obviously are differences in the procedural time, but yes, there can be late. It's not stent dislodgement in this case. You can always have a late embolism or thrombosis, but they're not really vastly different between the two procedures.
Okay.
And they don't require. I mean, the surveillance approach would be similar.
Let's then vote on 1540, a stroke or death after carotid endarterectomy. Does it meet NQF criteria for importance? Twenty yes, one no. Scientific acceptability. 6 completely, 14 partially, 1 minimally. Usability? Five completely, 14 partially, 1 minimally, 1 not at all. Feasibility? Four completely, 13 partially, 3 minimally, 1 not at all. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Thirteen yes, eight no. Now the same questions on carotid stenting, importance to measure and report. Keep pushing those buttons, please. Twenty-one yes. Scientific acceptability. Six completely, 14 partially, 1 minimally. Usability. Six completely, 13 partially, 1 minimally, 1 not at all. Feasibility. Six completely, 11 partially, 3 minimally, 1 not at all. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria? Seem to get that last one over the finish line. And maybe pushing the buttons all these times is wearing the batteries out. Fifteen yes, six no. Okay, I even though the last one is on carotid, I think we should take our 15-minute break and reconvene at... let's try shoot for 4:30.
Can I just say thank you to all of you for putting up with having this as a phone-in. We really appreciate the opportunity, and it's always difficult having done this many times. And I, my only other request, I would be curious if someone there could try to ascertain why the difference in meeting the criteria between the carotid and the aortic aneurysm is. I think that would be helpful to us to understand some of the feeling in the future. So anyway, thank you very much.
Fatigue, yeah.